All right, so this evening I'd like to talk about a series of things that are all in sequence, and I'm going to start with, I've kind of jokingly said the Buddha's advice on money management, but in fact, he did have very specific advice about householders, which is what we are, our acquisition of money and property and wealth, and how to manage that and what to do with it. And I'm going to do the short version of that. And one of the pieces that the Buddha thought and taught that was part of a balanced life and a balanced financial life was sharing what you acquired and sharing it in particular ways. And so I'm going to talk about that, which you probably won't be surprised leads to the discussion of this Dharma Center building that we're looking at. I don't think it is being overly dramatic or, we use in this culture, everything is extraordinary, and kind of exaggerated adjectives. But I actually think with the possibility of this building that it actually potentially is a historic thing for the development of Western Buddhist practice in this town, the possibility of actually putting down roots to allow the three key Western sanghas here in town to put down roots and to plant something for the next generation behind us. I think we're on the cusp of that. So, you don't know, but I think that's what we may be doing here. That's what I hope we're doing. And although it's called the Sacramento Dharma Center, the building, it's important to recognize that other traditions, such as Hindus and Muslims, refer to the Dharma. So we're actually talking about Buddha Dharma, a particular form of teaching that distinguishes itself in a number of very significant ways from other forms of practices that are available to us. Okay. So I just want to start very briefly with, well, what is the context for holding all of our teachings? And then where we're going with this topic, because we talk all the time about Buddhist practice and in particular, the at least the most fundamental model that this sangha is working on, which is the kind of the original teachings of the historical Buddha, which rightly or wrongly are referred to as Theravadan Buddhism. Theravadan Buddhism is really a group of people who are practicing in a particular way around the original teachings, okay? But the Theravadan Buddhism and Buddhism in general is talked about and described as being a wisdom tradition. And the reason that we describe it that way is the centerpiece of liberation, of the liberation of the mind from our reactivity and, whatever our favorite dysfunctional emotion is, and our favorite dysfunctional relationship with somebody that we can't get along with, getting liberated from that is ultimately the product of having a what's described as a piercing insight that is not the product of thinking or trying to figure it out. That there's this whole process, a whole series of practices that synergize, and those together create conditions which then open the mind and the heart, and there's this piercing moment of everything coming together and seeing things clearly, okay? And that's true. But if that's all that this was about, then it could get very, very dry. And some people think that that's what it is about and get very dry, because if what we think is that the the only thing there is this insight, then we're practicing in a particular way. And it can become, I think, distancing and esoteric and many things. So what is the thing that holds all of the teachings, all of the rest of the teachings, and then allows not just for this piercing insight to happen, but for that piercing insight to be held by the mind? Because some of these insights are very powerful things, and they're much bigger than the rational mind can handle. They can be destabilizing, they can be confusing. You know, in advanced practice, you know, we talk about anatta and anicca and impermanence and the absence of a permanent self, and we all kind of act like, oh, sure, I know what that is, you know. And I'll tell you, the first time that you have a deep one of these two experiences, it's something. It's disorienting. So what is it that allows us, the other piece of practice, that allows us to hold that, the mind to hold it, and not just to be stabilized and then not recover? And the answer to that question is care. Metta. Unconditional care and concern for ourselves, our own suffering, and for the suffering of other people and the suffering of animals on this planet and for the suffering of the environment. You know, we talk about metta as being kind of this fundamental friendliness, but its traditional definition, and when Kamala's here, I'm sure she'll talk about this, is that it is an unconditional care and concern, which is what makes it so extraordinary and then also so challenging, right? Because, you know, think about how many people you would say that your relationship with them is based on unconditional caring concern. I mean, there's almost always a hook, you know? Like, as long as you act like I'm a really thoughtful person, you know, I think you're great. And then when you stop acting that way, maybe I don't think you're so great. You know, and we don't even see that conditionality. And particularly in long-term relationships, you know, with couples, all this stuff develops, you know. So this idea of there being a caring concern that is absolutely foundational, it's like the sun, you know, it shines equally on every being and is concerned about every being suffering. That's what compassion is. Compassion is metta, unconditional care and concern, turned towards suffering. That's what compassion is. So compassion and metta aren't two different things. They're just two different versions, applications of the same thing. So the value of this, you know, I mean, in a very general, you know, in our tradition, we stay away from the term love. The Hindus love to use love. Okay? We stay away from it. Okay? Because it, for so many people, it's so confusing and has so much baggage. But one way to think of metta is this deep, deep, deep love that is not a romantic love. It's love with your eyes absolutely open. And so if you read our mission statement and why it would be important to have a permanent home to make this happen, this is what our mission statement says. It says, our mission is to serve as a learning, training, and community center for the development, integration, and skillful use of meditation practices and awareness in all aspects of individual, family, work, and community life. Our vision is, our mission is based on the vision that insight, Vipassana meditation, and meditative awareness are powerful resources for living, problem solving, and transformation, the continued individual and community exploration and development of these resources leads to a life of clarity, balance, and peace, which is expressed in the form of generosity, wisdom, compassion, and ethical conduct. These experiential results provide a basis for enormous hope for the emotional and spiritual health and well-being of each of us, our families, our institutions, and our communities. And those of us who wrote this believe every word of it, because we've had that happen in our lives. And the reason we're so dedicated to this is we know that this is actually possible. And so I'm not ashamed to say that I'm deeply in love with the Dharma, the Buddha Dharma. And I'm deeply in love with this practice. And that love is the source of, it sustains me. It sustains my life. So that softens everything else when you have that. And so you have a, you know, the piercing wisdom insight, and your mind can in some way absorb that and be kind to yourself, you know, and not so afraid, or not afraid at all, okay? And you can turn to the suffering of somebody else. You know, we always say, where this care comes from is a recognition that the worst pain and suffering you felt in your life, in the most isolated moment of your heart, we've all felt this, that every other human being has felt that. And so the question, you know, that I always ask, well, who are they talking about? You know, and who they're talking about is the person who's sitting next to you. That's when it starts to become a community. That we actually know this to be true. That there is this deep suffering that we all go through. And it is a commonality and the extraordinary thing about these teachings, because the mind has a certain formula of operation, that this has the possibility of leading us all out of it. And so that by developing ourselves, we help support other people, and by them developing themselves, they support us. So the Buddha said that to be a householder, that as opposed to a monk, because a monk or a nun, because it's clear that if you're a monk or a nun, you're doing all kinds of extreme things. You're not living a balanced life. Right? And I mean, and no one's trying to portray that as being balanced. I'm going to have to roll up my sleeves now, getting into this stage of the talk. you know, the life of a monk or a nun, if you talk with anyone who has done that, so like Kamala and Stephen both have, Stephen was a monk for 5 years, and Kamala has gone in and come out on a number of occasions being a nun. And you talk to anybody who's done that kind of, they'll tell you it's not a balanced life. You know, you go in and, you know, all of your regular clothes you can't take with you. They cut your hair off. You know, they give you two robes and a bowl and a pair of sandals, and, you know, that's it. And you get up at 3:30 in the morning, and afternoon you can't eat, and, you know, it's like, wow, okay, sign me up. But it is, you know, it's a wonderful life if you're ready for it. Yeah. You know, it's a wonderful life. But it is not a balanced life. So the Buddha said that it's important that as a householder that you create a balanced life in every aspect of your life. You know, your thinking, your emotions, and what have you. And specifically with respect to property and wealth, the first thing he said is that it is important that we be responsible and actually have some reasonable amount of wealth and property so that we can sustain ourselves and our families. You know, that kind of the 60s idea that being poor was had something to do with purity. You know, like, I'll get rid of everything and I'll be much better. Well, not everything, you know. And so the Buddha was not at all, you know, as radical as many of his thoughts were. He was not against property ownership. He did not advocate that. He was not against wealth. He didn't advocate that. He said that it was important to have that, and that once you got it, that it was important, assuming that you got it ethically. Okay? Assuming that you got it ethically, that it was important to protect it, to look after it, and to try to be debtless. You know, so this was like going on 3,000 years ago, right? Just like it's so logical, right? So that was the first thing he had to say. And then he said, with respect to what you do with it, he said for consumption, use, and sharing of it, that should be done in a balanced way. It's just everything is having to do with balance. So he said for its consumption, use, and sharing, that there were three areas. One was for yourself, to do what you needed to do to take care of yourself and stay healthy. And the second was sharing it with your family, with your in-laws. That always gets a little clap. With your friends and with the disadvantaged. That was kind of category number two. And then number three was supporting one's spiritual practice and the your spiritual community, your Sangha, and whoever was carrying the Dharma, you know, your teachers. So those are the three areas: yourself, sharing with your family, in-laws, friends, and disadvantage, and the final is, you know, the whole spiritual piece. And of the, you know, there's a lot of talk, I'm not going to go into it a lot tonight, but in Buddhism there's a lot of talk about action being meritorious and having to do with your intention. But in addition to that, the Buddha identified, you know, once again, kind of like framing what the balance looks like, that meritorious action fell into three broad categories. The first category was sharing or giving. The second was ethical conduct or morality, and the third was mental or wisdom development. So the notion of being in balance and part of that balance involving a sharing of what we have, and it extends not just to money and property, but to our time and our effort. So we might not be in a position to be generous financially, but we may be in a position to be generous with our time and our effort. Or we may not be in a position really to do either of those, and we do it anyway. You know, because this is important to us, or because we love it, you know, however, we're all at a different stage of practice, you know, but because it's important to us or because we love it, we rearrange things. And rather than just doing something that's a, you know, something that's just for sheer pleasure or something else, I mean, we actually do something that in our own mind initially becomes kind of a sacrifice, because we want to develop a certain part of our life, that we want to be in balance in a particular way. So with respect to sharing, I find this interesting because I'm sure you've heard some of this before, and this is a little bit different, this particular sutta. So in terms of, it comes out of a sutta that the Buddha gave at Srivasti, which is where the famous Jetta's Grove, where Prince Jetta bought this big grove. And Srivasti is the most fantastic place. In going on pilgrimage, everybody seems to get lit up at a different place. And for me, that's the place. It's just electrifying to be there, because you know that the historical Buddha and everyone, this whole big group of wise people and his whole teaching team spent at least 24 years of rains retreats at that location. I mean, we know that to be true. And there was a little hospital and a pharmacy and all these things, and all of those are there, you know. So when you're on that ground, you know that the historical Buddha and Moggallana and Ananda and all these people and all the famous nuns were all there on that land. It's quite an experience. So he was giving a talk there, and there was a lay donor who wanted to contribute to the Sangha. And so the Buddha said, well, there are, for someone to make a donation, that they should be endowed. Any sharing or contribution should be endowed with six factors. And three of them are for the giver, relate to the giver, the state of mind of the giver, and three of them relate to the person who's receiving it. And so I think the three for the person who's receiving it is particularly applicable to our current situation. So for the donor, the Buddha said the first thing is that before you give the money, when you reflect on it, the purpose of giving it, the benefit that you think it will create, that it should make you glad. That you should have a good feeling, you know, that there should provide you with some sympathetic joy. This is like a good thing to do, and I'm glad to do it, you know. The second one is while you're giving it, you know, like you're writing out the chart, okay, while you're giving it. Does anybody have any idea what this one is? I think this will surprise you. Does anybody have even a guess of, like, while you're actually giving it, what would be the quality of mind?
Non-attachment.
Kind of indirectly. Okay. Any other thoughts? Okay. So the Buddha said that while giving, he or she should have a bright and a clear mind. You know that. Your mind is not clouded by wanting a particular result. I mean, you may envision that, but you're not attached to the result. That you're making a wise decision, since this is a wisdom practice. You know, it's just not like you look and you see, I'm not doing this just because I'm lit up. You know, yeah, I'm excited. Give me my checkbook. Okay? Like, no, this is like a sound decision. You know, like seeing clearly. And then the third one is after giving, that he or she should feel gratified or satisfied. That, like, yeah, you know, I was glad to do this. It was a sound decision, and I feel good about it. I'm satisfied. So that's on the donor's side. Okay. So now this is the recipient. And all of us know, like, how hard it is to take a compliment, or at least most of us feel that way. Isn't that right? Mm-hmm. Like, okay. Here, give me a compliment. Let's see.
Love the shirt you're wearing tonight.
Great smile.
Well, thank you.
I like the presentation.
Very. Now, this is a wise person. So, you know, there is lots of excitement around this building. And the excitement can get a little crazy. You know, I mean, people start having big dreams, which is a nice thing, you know. And and so it's easy to kind of get carried away and maybe not see as clearly as we should. You know, we want to make a sound decision. So with that in mind, or any time you've wanted to buy a new car, or you met a new person and were just like totally enamored with them, you know, like I've been joking with one of my friends, I went in, I had a little rash on my face, and I went in for this dermatology appointment, and so they said, well, Dr. So-and-so is going to see you, and I don't know who Dr. So-and-so is, you know, so they say, I come in and this really pretty Indian girl is the technician that waits on me and takes me in the room, and then she gives me a gown and says, okay, well, you know, take off your clothes except for your underpants and your socks and put this gown on and leave it open on the back. And I kind of looked at her and she said, well, do you have a problem with that? And I said, well, I'm here for a little bit. And so she said, well, it's a normal part for a first visit that, you know, they examine your whole body, you know, for skin cancers and what have you. Okay, you know, so I put this thing on, and you know, yeah, you feel kind of stupid with one of those on, you know, kind of vulnerable. So, and they've got the little thing around the door, so the door opens and the curtain opens, and this little Korean girl walks in who could be my daughter and maybe my granddaughter, and is one of the cutest people I've ever seen in my life. And it was like, okay, I feel pretty good about having this guy. And I got really enthusiastic about the appointment. And so that would be an illustration of like maybe losing your balance. So the recipient of a contribution or a sharing, there are three elements. Hey, and I'm not joking either. They say a good Dharma teacher is willing to completely humiliate themselves. So the first thing is that they should be free of passion with respect to what they're receiving, or the object, or is practicing to subdue passion. Okay, so what does that mean? Passion we normally associate like with love, you know, like I say, or I'm very passionate about something. And in this sense, the Buddha used the term passion as a heightened form of interest.
Right. Okay. Could easily be greed, right? I mean,
it is a form of greed.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a heightened form of desire. And so later in the suttas, you will hear the Buddha frequently say that you reach stages in your development where you are, quote, passionless. And people read that and they think, well, geez, you know, is this just supposed to be like a vanilla ice cream thing? You know, everything is. And no, that's not it at all. It's like the second one is having a bright and a clear mind. If you're just filled with passion, which is this elevated desire, your mind can't be bright and clear. You know, it's clouded by that passion. So that's the first thing he's saying, that you can't be, you know, lost in your desire about having a new Dharma center. And the second one is free of aversion, or practicing to subdue aversion. So, you know, an illustration would be is, gee, could that person have contributed more? You know? Which isn't what it's about at all. It's like somebody contributes something, whatever it is, you know. And then the third one is free of delusion, or is practicing to subdue delusion. Okay, you know how carried away we get. And the reason I use that illustration about my dermatologist is that is that all of us have had the experience of meeting somebody, and you know, it's just like, this is maybe the most only person I've ever met in my life that's perfect, right? And I mean, we actually have that idea, we're so enamored with them, and then you know, you hang out with them for a while and you suddenly realize that, well, maybe they're not perfect, you know, maybe they're like you, you know, maybe they have issues and stuff, you know. So that's this last one. It's like, it's easy, like, to go over and look at a building like this, which is a beautiful building, and go like, oh, my, geez, we got to get it. And, well, maybe there's some big problems sitting there, right? That we want to, that's what due diligence is about. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. So that leads to, well, what did the Buddha say were the four things that, in terms of a spiritual life, that were sources of meritorious giving. And he said, first, a dwelling suitable for spiritual practice. Secondly, food. Third, this is for monks and nuns, clothing. And then alms bowls. You know. So there's a Bhuta on sutta on what is a suitable dwelling for a spiritual practice. So I want you to look at the picture here. So the thing that's amazing about this place, as you can see, is that it is heavily treed. And one of our requirements, each of the Sangha had requirements that were with their practice, so they were non-negotiable. And ours was that there had to be adequate outdoor walking space. Because in our tradition, from the day that the Buddha was awakened under a tree, and they practiced outside, and all of the insight, vipassana, Theravadan centers in the U.S., all are on properties that have lots of foliage and trees. So as you can see, this does. It's amazing. And it's on 1.7 acres, which is a big. So in the back of this building, in addition to parking, there's this whole big area of land, you know, and everybody's going to the delusion piece, already all kinds of ideas about, you know, a community garden and, you know, having a children's program and having all kinds of stuff back there and, you know, maybe a labyrinth and who knows what, okay? Lots of dreaming, good dreaming. Now I'm going to read to you what the test is, okay? So there's five advantages to a suitable location. The first one is that the dwelling is not too far and not too near and is suitable for going and returning. So this building from here, if you drive down Howe Avenue to Folsom Boulevard and turn to the left, and you'll immediately run into Rayleigh's on the left-hand side, right? Mm-hmm. And the second light there is light rail. Mm-hmm. You go one more light, turn to the left, that's Wiseman Drive, and there is a big church, there's a savings and loan, another big church, and then a really nice residential community, mm-hmm. which a lot of my daughter's friends live in, and this is where this is. So when you turn that corner right away, just watch, and you go into a driveway, and then it's set off. So it's not too far, it's not too near, it's suitable for returning. And, you know, for our Sangha in particular, I mean, it's 10 minutes from here. It's amazing. Okay. So second one, in the daytime, it is not too crowded, and at night, it is without much noise and bustle. So it's close to Folsom, but it's off of Folsom, and when you get in that building, you don't hear any of it. It's almost 8,000 square feet.
Yeah, I wonder how they found anything in India that fit
that. Well, the test in India was that you couldn't have it near the watering source in the community, because that's where everyone would come and wash their clothes and talk. Okay, so it couldn't be near that. And near and far was in relationship to going out on alms rounds. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't put the Sangha, you know, like out in the country where it would be really quiet, and then have to walk in 5-10 miles to do alms rounds. Okay. So, and maybe we'll all have to do alms rounds if we get this fellowship.
Should be a good place.
Okay, so number three. One is not much molested there by gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, sun, and creeping things. So, with all those trees, I think we're in pretty good shape. I've been over there a couple times and haven't been molested by creeping things yet. So, all right. Say it again.
That's the part about the pest inspection.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, due diligence. They're doing a pest inspection. So now this has to do with monks and nuns, but it says while living there, the monk without difficulty can obtain robes, alms, food, dwelling, and the necessary medicines. And this building was actually the house of two small savings and loans. So there will be one like big Dharma hall in the back, and then in the front where there are some offices on one side, and then there's, you know, like when you go into a bank and there's the teller's counters, they have some of those, and I guess that's going to be like the Donna counters. But right in the center, you know, there's a nice reception area and a false wall and some offices. So once there's enough money, that would all come out and be carpeted and be perfect for another relatively sized, big size Sangha event. So you could have two full Sangha events from two different Sanghas going on at the same time with no trouble, because what's in between those two spaces is a big, what they use as a conference room, which would be a perfect, you know, like our little room back there, it's probably three or four times that big. So it'd be great for, you know, a 20 or 25 person class, you know, or a workshop. Then there's two small kitchens. They each had their own little kitchen. And then over on the other side, there's a whole area that is, you know, there's floor-to-ceiling windows every place on this, so all kinds of light. And over on that side, there's this whole area for tables, you know, for it's a break area. It's fantastic, right, for people to be able to come in and come early, have dinner, sit back there and talk, just what we need, you know, to be a community. And then those would act as a buffer between the two, you know. So we would be able to obtain food. Be able to do that. And there will probably be the necessary medicines for an emergency. Okay. So, and then the final one is that there are elders, and this is living there, we'll be visiting, we'll be part, but elders living there with great learning, well-versed in the teachings, who can be approached from time to time for questions and explanations. So, you know, each of the sanghas has the people that we view as, you know, our elders, right, who are trying to carry the Dharma and then cultivate the next generation of mentors and teachers. So it seems like a pretty good fit. So, okay, so now I'm going to talk about the building itself and finances, because we as a board have felt that it's awfully important for us to start talking about money and finances regularly and be very transparent. That isn't something we've done well in the past. And particularly when we're talking about, we're being asked to guarantee basically $1 million transaction. It's a pretty big decision, okay? So where things are right now is that there were negotiations on the price. It started, I think, at 1.2, and the actual sale price is $950,000. The down payment is $382,000, which leaves reserves of just about $50,000. So not a lot. And the loan is for $568,000. It's a 10-year loan with a balloon at the end. A contract has been signed. It is in escrow. Due diligence is going on now. You just don't know. I mean, this building was built in 82 when they were still using like really nice building materials. So the building itself, I think, is in really excellent shape. It's got these great big beautiful wood beams, a building that was built in 1982 is undoubtedly going to have some issues. So it was suspected, and an inspection took place yesterday, that we're going to need to put a new roof on it. And, you know, that's $60,000 or $70,000 right there. Boom, you know. There are some ADA compliance issues. I don't think they're huge ones, but you get that. The owners are taking the refrigerators. We need a couple of pretty soon. It doesn't take too long for all of that to really build up. So the bottom line is that while we're on the cusp of getting this, we've got this loan. The Sacramento Dharma Center, which is a separate corporation with that was established to locate and purchase the building and then manage it, has representatives of each of the three sanghas on it. They need additional funds in order to pull this off, to actually make it happen. They're estimating, some of you heard me give a talk 5 or 6 weeks ago, and I said, I think we need $250,000. The estimate that they've come out with is $230,000. And we probably need more than that, because that's to get in and have the fundamentals done. This big back room, we could start using immediately. It's in such good shape. The front area, you'd have to raise the funds at some point to pull that out, carpet it, and have the second. So, it's going to be a project. It's going to take time. Okay. So, what is SIM being asked to do? SIM's being asked to do two things. The first thing is that the Safe Credit Union that is extending the loan is asking SIM and the other two sanghas to sign a loan guarantee, which basically says if the SDC were to default on their loan, we would be liable for it, which of course would wipe us out if there was actually some kind of a big debt, right? So we've looked at this very carefully, retained not-for-profit lawyers, specialists, got an opinion, and in the end feel very, very comfortable about it. And the reason we feel so comfortable is just because of the economics. This building is selling for $950,000, and basically $400,000 is being put down with a $600,000 loan. The SDC, we could move in and the next day default. And the bank already has $400,000 in equity. So if the building's worth on the open market right now $950,000, they could sell it for $700,000. They would pay off the loan and still have $100,000 left. Okay? So we feel that absent the entire economy collapsing, the world economy and us with it, the possibility of us actually having any real risk is almost non-existent. So we started off all of the sanghas thinking this is like a deal breaker, and now I think it's not an issue at all. I think all of us feel very, very comfortable with it. The second piece is that the bank is asking all of the sanghas to sign a 5-year commercial lease because the core revenue that for the mortgage to be paid by the SDC is the rent from the three sanghas. Okay, so we were required ourselves, SBMG, and Valley Stream Zen Group, were all required to submit 3 years of financials. So the bank knows all about our capacities and what have you. So, For us to do this, we're kind of growing up because we've had this favored position of being here. We've been here for almost 14 years. We've never had a lease. Easiest thing in the world, right? It's like almost no obligation. Like pay on a quarterly basis and never have to make a long-term commitment. We're paying like half of what SBMG pays for their space. So we've never had to really face that kind of thing, right? So for us to say we're signing a 5-year lease, and when we move into this center, this portion of our budget doubles because we'll now start paying what everybody else in the world pays, okay? That's a big thing. This is going to be a big transition for us. So I said in the opening sheet here, you know, there is this dynamic where the minute we move in, our costs double as far as rent is concerned. And although it's been kind of floated around that maybe by contributing to the Dharma Center that we end up not paying as much rent, that would happen when the loan is paid off. Not going to happen before then. Okay, so the reality is we move in, our rent goes up, and you know, as a community, we have to figure out how to handle that. So, is this financially feasible? We've looked at all the workup with the even at a rental rate that is less than we know that we're going to pay. The monthly rental rate of the three sanghas plus the revenue that comes in from people who are contributing, like sustaining donors, is, and you can see it, you don't have to look at it now, but on this back sheet it outlines it, is well over what the monthly mortgage would be. So they're still putting together a budget for monthly operations, you know, utilities and all those kinds of things. But the expectation is that they'll be easily be able to pay the mortgage, pay monthly expenses, put a little bit into reserves, and pay more than the mortgage to try to bring the mortgage down quicker. Okay. That's the basic plan. And that seems completely reasonable based on all of the financial data. Okay. So they say they're looking for an additional $230,000, and they're looking for that to do two things. One is to cover capital improvements and anything that comes up in due diligence, such as a roof, and the second is to pay down the pay more on the down payment so that the amount of the loan is reduced. Okay, those are the two things. So the SIM board has looked at this very, very carefully, and our decision is to fully back this effort and assign the guarantee. We don't feel that that's a risk to enter into the 5-year lease, which is an act of faith on the generosity of the community. We had already contributed $5,000, and we are going to contribute $11,000 more. It's 11 because we did 10, and then we've been caring for a long time. One person in the community had donated $1,000 and said, you know, if you ever get a building, here's the $1,000. That's the only thing I want it to be spent for. Okay, so that's the reason it's 11. So it's 16,000. Each member of the board has contributed substantially, either financially or with considerable time and effort. One of the two. I gave a talk 6 weeks ago, and I think I was probably violating this thing about passion. And I kind of gave this pitch about we need, you know, $250,000, and there's an angel out there, you know, come forward and what have you. And I gave that talk and felt pretty good about the talk and went home, and there was quite a bit of silence. And then I got an email from Terry Townsend, who has been our retreat manager for the last 2 years. And Terry said, I don't have anything like $250,000, but I can make a contribution, which, in my opinion, is very substantial. And so that was really significant to me because what it made me realize after I talked with Terry was that what I was doing, you know, the mantra about getting a building from everybody is, well, the way it happens is at the end, once you can see the building, somebody steps forward with all this money. And actually, that's happened repeatedly. Big money, okay? And like Mountain Stream up in Nevada City, somebody stepped forward right at the end. $275,000, one person. That's what allowed them to get the building. So no one was knocking down the door with $250,000. And I started thinking about it, and I thought, you know, all of my thinking is actually wrong about this, because another seminal aspect of Buddhism mm-hmm. is what? Self-responsibility. You know, to actually take responsibility. And I thought about that, and, you know, I'd been kind of saying to myself, well, you know, I can't... make any donation that looks significant at all. You know, the circumstances of my life the last 2 years, a lot of things have changed, and I just can't do that. So I thought about it. I said, well, okay, I'm taking money out of my pension fund to do this, and I'm going to send a note to 15 or 16 people and tell them that I'm doing that and ask them if they can join me in doing something. And so, to start this off, a number of people, let me see how many people. Okay, so 14 people in the last 3 weeks got in touch with me, and I think they feel the way I do. I think they feel that some of them have contributed before and are contributing again. Some of them, it's their first time. And I think all of us feel the same way. It's like, we're not in a position to do this. And we're not in a position not to do it. It's like, this is a chance that we can't let go. So 14 people with donations between $500 and $20,000. Totaling $86,600. So I consider that the seed money towards getting to this 230 or this 250 figure. And those are all people in this community who are stepping up to do that. So what I'd like to do is just have some of them come up, and I'd just like to recognize them, and not anybody in particular, because there's 14 of them, but and just say why they think this is important and why they're contributing. You know, I think it's important to hear those voices. So, Sarah, could you come up? Ara? Terry? Barbara? Is Barbara still out there? Mm-hmm. You want to come up? So Ara Karamanoukian, Sarah Densler, Barbara Colton, and Barbara Colton in just a minute. If you're moved to contribute something at any level at all, Barbara's going to be the point person. So you can email her. She has the pledge forms, and I'm going to explain to you how that works. And Terry Townsend, who I'm hoping is going to be the retreat manager this year as well. So, whoever wants to go first. Why don't you go first, since you were first? You kind of started this.
I was inspired by your talk. You know what? I started Insight Meditation. I wasn't quite sure what to expect, and I started at the beginning class, kind of like Rich. Rich was the teacher. He was the co-teacher. It was your last class, and it was Rich. And I think it might have been your first beginning meditation class. And it was held over at the Unitarian Church. And I remember that when you signed up, they said you're going to have a one-day silent retreat. And I was immediately panicked about having to have a silent time. I didn't know how I would do. And so I took the class, and I enjoyed it. But meditation's a real challenge if you don't practice. And the experience I had was when we had the one-day retreat, we got to do a lot of walking. And that is when I discovered how beautiful this practice is, because that's where I connect. And I think the thing that I loved about it is that the Unitarian grounds are really very pretty grounds. And you know, there was a lot of history there, and there were a lot of kind of little grove areas and a lot of flowers, and there was an actual garden. And so when we first started looking for a place, and then it fell through, the first one, I was kind of disappointed, because I thought, you know, this is a really nice place. I love the location, and the grounds are pretty, but it's also tiny. We can't really, no complaining here, but I mean, it just, I had visions of something that would be, have a bigger space on the outside, let me say that. So, when I got wind that there was another place with some grounds to walk, I became kind of a weasel and started checking out where I might find out where it was. And so I did. I found out the location. And when I went over, I wasn't able to get inside. But when I saw the grounds and I saw the potential in the grounds, I could see what this could be. And I got really excited. And, you know, there's so many wonderful people in this group that I've come to know and share time with, whether it's quiet time or not. And it's a wonderful experience to be a part of a group like this. And it's a wonderful experience to be quiet for a while and be outside and understand the interconnectedness of all of it. And have a great teacher like Dennis, who and mentors like Rich and Diane, all of them who have touched me as I've progressed in this practice. So I'm honored to be able to contribute in a small way to the growth, and I'm really excited about where this may go. So that's my story.
I've been practicing with Sim for 10, 12 years, something like that. I think I started in 2004. And I don't remember the year that the initial explorations for SDC started. There was something prior to before it became SDC. And for me, it was a sense of wanting to, I really like Sim and I identify with Sim, but I wanted there to be part of a community and a larger community. So there has been, it's been a lot of steps to get to the point of actually finding a space where a larger community would develop and where we would each have our own identity, Sim and SBMG and Valley Stream. I know very little about Valley Stream. But I feel like this is something that the average age in this room is probably up there. But I'm hopeful that there will be something that will continue, and that this practice, which has been very important to me personally, will be something that will continue in ways that I probably can't anticipate, but
I think having a permanent facility, one that we will call home, that we don't, you know, have to put everything away and put our signs away so their signs can come out. And the learning that goes on in living in community, because there's a lot of learning. I've only been on the board for a couple of years, but there's a lot to learn about cooperation and collaboration, and there will be many more opportunities to learn that working with the three groups in this arrangement. But there are models for it elsewhere, and it's something that's important to me, and so I'm willing to support it financially, and it'll last, I hope, much longer than I do. So it's important.
Well, I was inspired by Dennis's talk a month or so ago, but I also I kind of reacted to the way oh my God, I'm totally blanking. I'm sorry, Terry. We're all getting up in that age range. Did in terms of sort of the size of the, or maybe I'm projecting that onto you, but I sort of thought, well, I don't have $200,000 to give, mm-hmm. So I sort of wrote, you know, I mean, it's just sort of. And I had signed up to be a donor on an ongoing basis, but on a really pretty low level. And when I got Dennis's email, I was just really moved by it, because I came to this practice because I had met Dennis at a particular presentation that, and I remember when he introduced it, I said, I think I have something to learn from this person, and so I met him afterwards, but then I didn't. It's still like two more years before I actually got involved. So I'm a little slow mover there, but and when he wrote and, you know, sort of explained, I mean, I was aware of his situation financially, and when I heard that he was saying, you know, I believe in this enough to put money into this, even though it's not something I feel like I have a lot to give, just in terms of the circumstances. It really made me stop and look at my circumstances, and most of my adult life, I mean, I've always had a good job, a secure job at the state, but it's always been kind of, you know, it's been enough, and by the world standards, I have been rich my whole life, but I've always felt like I was, you know, had a long way to go to get to a secure retirement, and, you know, I've always felt pretty contracted around money, and it, just in the last couple of years, a couple things have changed where I'm in a better position now with my money, and I'm hoping to retire in a couple of years. And so it really made me stop and say, like, well, what's this story in my head about, like, oh, I can't afford to give, you know, like, what, let's look at it, you're saying, like, with a clear mind and say, what could I give? What would be a reasonable amount that I could give? And so I really looked at it and found great joy come up in finding that, oh, I really could give more than what I've been, the theme I've been playing, the story I've been telling of lack and everything is like that, you know, that was true for a long time and it's not true right now. And so it just felt like this really great timing for me, because in a few years, if I do retire, I'll be back on a more fixed income and lower level. So I just thought, okay, this is the moment when I can do this. And it has brought me great joy to think that I can actually do it and do it for an organization that I do believe in so strongly. And the other thing that I'll say is that going to India with Dennis a year and a half ago really just changed a lot of things in my perspective, but also being at Jetta's Grove was like one of the most significant places for me. And I'm very in tune with nature and really love spending time outside, and so that was one of the things that was really just very significant for me. And I hadn't seen the new property yet or even knew where it was when I made the commitment, and I kind of had to stop and say, am I committed enough to make a pledge when I don't know if it's going to be near my house or be, you know, what I would want or whatever? And I said, yes, I am, because the long-term stability of the organization is more important than my particular preferences around this. And so I went ahead and told Dennis that I would commit some money to it. And then I kind of was able to find out a little bit about where I was. And the blessing for me is it turns out it's only a couple miles from my house. So I love the idea that I could actually go home for dinner and then come to Sim for a change, which is wonderful. But I also, tonight, listening to you describe the place, I really like the idea of coming beforehand and having dinner with people in the community and having more of an opportunity to create that sense of community, because, you know, I've been involved in different groups throughout my life, and that I really value that. And I've been involved with Sim, and I've kind of been here and in and out at different times, depending on what was going on for me. But as I get older, particularly, I just really realize the importance of community and, you know, the having like-minded friends. I mean, they're great with diversity and everything, but it gives you strength to be with people and actually support each other and looking at the world and meeting challenges in a certain way. And so I just think that having our own space in concert with the other groups will just be a really amazing opportunity for us. So thank you all for listening.
Well, I was introduced to the practice at least 6 years ago from the first book I read. Every word, every little story, it just made so much sense. I truly fall in love with the practice, and I was very fortunate. I know Dennis for over 18 years, a close friend of mine, and made it much easier for me just to pick up the phone and talk to him. And every time when we had our business meeting, I was trying to find the time to start asking questions and get introduced or know more about the practice. It truly did change my life, made me a better husband, better father, just really a better human being. This practice, it does work for me, every part of it. And spiritually and in life, at work, I implement it everywhere. And it does wonder, especially after coming to a few the residential retreats a couple of years ago and finding out the possibility. I didn't even scratch the surface yet, but there's so much more to do. And it's a wonderful thing. The community here, it's been great. When I wasn't here for Dennis' talk, probably a month ago, but when I got his email, and when I sat down with my wife, next day we were talking about it, and you always, you know, it's never the right time to give money. You know, you have plans, you have other things, but what the practice did for us, what this center did for us, everybody, Dennis, Richard, Diane, and every time I see all the members here, the board members and all the volunteers, they put so much time, which is I don't have now with what I have in my life. It was the right thing to be done. I never felt comfortable just donating money, but felt so comfortable, so right for this cause, because I know how much it did for me, and I really truly want the same thing for other people in the future and for the group here. And I hope there will be room for my kids to benefit from what we try to put together here with them and other families and other members. And again, thank you for all the members here. I'm always just shocked all the hard work everybody put here, taking away from their families, their work, or whatever in their life. It's amazing. Appreciate it.
And other folks who are part of this this group that I've been talking about is Renee Coombs, who's a member of our board, Maxine Cornwell, longtime member of the Sangha, and one of the contributors, the original contributors to the SDC as well. Let's see, who else is here? And Kathy Vigran, who's on our board and was one of the original contributors as well. So thank you to everybody. And I'd like to give some special recognition to Ara and his wife, Viva, who's here tonight. Ara, by the way, has one of the most beautiful wives. Daughters. And they're contributing $20,000 to this effort, so it's really, it really significant. So, if you're interested in contributing at whatever level, you might be able to contribute, and the amount isn't the key part. It's whatever you think you could do, you know. There's a number of ways you can do it. You could actually make a contribution now, or what most of us are doing is signing a pledge form that is tied specifically to this piece of property. And so you could pay the money, and the pledge is tied to that, and if this whole thing falls apart and we don't get the building, you could leave the money in, with the STC Capital Fund, or the money would be returned to you, or you can sign a pledge that says, I will contribute X number of dollars when escrow closes. So whatever way is fine, you know. If they have a pledge on the close of escrow, then, you know, they can count on that, all right? Because the way the pledge is set up is you give a credit card or a check or something, and then at the close of escrow, they have the ability to cash it. And so the bank knows that as well in terms of considering everything. Several people are making like half of the funds that they're contributing. They're going to pay that at the close of escrow, and then the other half is going to be paid over the rest of a year. So I know that the SDC is pleased with that to the degree that we've got it right now, because there's this guaranteed cash flow for the rest of the year. So, you know, you could, that would be another option that you could do. What we would like to do, if possible, is that everyone from our community who is doing this, we'd like to do it together. So Barbara Colton is going to be the point person, and all of us, myself, any member of the board, Brian, it's just our first name, like Barbara, at sacramentoinsight.org.
SactoInsight.org.
And to be safe, you can go up on the website and look, contact us and make sure. But if you're interested in making a contribution, send a note to Barbara. She will send you a pledge form, and then we can go from there. If you have questions about any of this, I mean, whatever it may be, so that you feel comfortable, if you have financial questions, anything about the feasibility of it, don't hesitate to contact me directly, because I've been the point person on all of the economics and working with them, and would be more than happy to talk with you. This is, for me, a very significant thing. So, and there's no stupid questions and no questions that are too small. We are trying... and this is going to be on tape, so there are a number of people who wrote and said they couldn't make it tonight, but they'll listen to the tape. We're trying to, if you're going to make a contribution, we'd like to know by next Friday, in 10 days, okay? So that we really have an idea of what our community is going to be able to generate here, and so does the SDC, okay? At some point, you know, if it would be significant for you to see the building, we might be able to get you in. At some point, there's going to be an open house, but I think it's unclear at this point what the scope of the open house, if there's going to be multiple ones for different people. So, you know, we'll let you know about that.
There'll be one.
Just one.
On the 5th of March.
Okay. So there'll be one on the 5th of March. Okay. So... if you've made a pledge, you can go over, and if you haven't and feel that that's important, the 5th is the day. Did you?
So then, what are our other expenses going to be once we move in there? And has the board figured out, you know, what our, we won't be renting this place, we will have additional expenses in addition to the rent there, right?
We won't have, not in addition to our rent. I mean, there's probably going to be some moving expenses, and it's such a big haul you know, I mean, we haven't talked about this. My idea is actually having some tankas painted for us in Nepal, some big long ones, you know. But at least initially, the issue is just that our budget is probably going to go from about $75,000 a year to $100,000 a year. Okay, that's what we're doing there. Okay. So I'm almost done. All right. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
It's more of a rent question, so I can ask it later. I don't need to ask it right now.
Okay. All right. So that's basically it. You know. So we're encouraging you, if you want to contribute to the capital fund now, and then anticipate that when we move, if this goes through, which will be 4 to 6 months. That we're all going to have to chip in at a little higher level to pay the rent, you know, for this to work. Okay. So in closing, I'd just like to, I realize that there was one person who has contributed as part of this list that I didn't recognize, who's another board member, who's James Barnes in the back of the room. He and his wife have contributed. James, thank you very much. Okay. And I just want to recognize in closing a group of people who, from the very beginning, have been people who have been working on this for years and making this happen. So kind of the core people are Susan Orr, John Penfield, Linda Decker. All of these people are features of the local community. They, you know, when we were all together 20 years ago, or 25 years ago now at SBMG, when it was first formed, all of these people were part of the original community. So Susan Orr, John Penfield, Linda Decker, Helen Hobart, Jim Hare, who's head of the Zen group now, our own Jerry Simkin, who was president of our group, and is still, even though he was president of the SDC and is now on a number of their committees, Candace McGuggan, who's very active in Diane's prison group, Rich Howard, that they consider his contribution from the kind of the inner Sangha relationship very important. Joanne Sebastiani in the back of the room has been our representative on the board and has been unbelievably active. She's been one of the key people in the building search. And John Phelps, who's not here tonight, he's on retreat, has also been our representative. So it takes a lot of people to make something like this happen. And it's going to take a lot more people, you know, to make it happen. So, may all of our efforts in some very genuine way, even if we're not in a position to contribute, be a small piece in making a home for the Western Dharma here in Sacramento. And may that Dharma help all of us to find a path out of suffering and a path into true peace for ourselves and our children and for the rest of the world. Thank you very much.